Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Listen Up with Jim Potts, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, Jim Potts back on the air. And as always, thank you so much for sharing your Sunday evening with me. And this time I can truly say evening because I am actually broadcasting from the East Coast this week out here taking care of, as much business as I can. Today, we're going to be talking about 9 tips for more effective school lockdowns. We're also going to be discussing reasons why inner city schools do not experience mass shootings. And then, as I told you, I'm always going to be trying to do an historical piece as well. And today we're going to be talking about an actual shooting at the U.S. Capitol. Yeah, at the Capitol of all places. So let's go ahead and get busy. But before I get really into this, I have to say a couple of things. One, if anybody would like to call in, that number is 818-602-4929. Again, that's 818-602-4929. Or you can email me at listenupwithjp@pottsassociates.com. Again, that's listenupwithjp@pottsassociates.com. And if you want to get on my blog or my email blast about the upcoming show topics, just text Potts Associates and text that to 22828 and enter your email address. Again, that's Potts Associates and text that to 22828 and enter your email address. And then you'll get the upcoming shows at that point, whatever's going to be on tap for that upcoming Sunday. You know, before we get into this, because you know I like reading the emails next, I really have to talk about something that's, you know, in so many respects is really sad. Now, you know how I've always been preaching about being safe and safety and things of that nature and being careful with guns. We've had many discussions on that, the CCWs. Here's a situation where I don't know if some of you, you know, out here on the East Coast may not have heard of this, or maybe some on the West Coast that haven't heard of this. A toddler shoots his mother with his shotgun from the back seat of their car. That's right. You heard me correct. A toddler. This child was under 4 years of age, shoots his mother with a shotgun from the back seat of the car. And that happened in Norwalk, California. He critically wounded his mother. Now, you have to, and this is the family car. What in the world are they doing with a shotgun in the back seat? There's 2 other children in the back seat as well. Now, according to the LA County Sheriff's Department, she was shot at about 3:30 p.m. And the preliminary information gathered at the scene revealed that the family's 3 children were in the back seat of the vehicle when one of their children accessed an unsecured shotgun and shot her through the back of the seat. I mean, when I read this, as I go through, you know, a lot on the internet, you know, to look for things that I'm going to be talking about. I mean, I was, you know, amazed. And this was actually on the news, and I was amazed. Now, apparently the mother was sitting in the driver's seat and her son, when the son shot her. Now, you know, I tell people all the time now, you know, sometimes people carry guns because they're really concerned about, you know, safety, things of that nature. But a shotgun, well, shotguns have safeties on them also. So why in the world would you have a loaded shotgun in the back seat of the car with 3 children and no safety on the gun at all? Again, this is just amazing to me. Fortunately, the mother is recovering at this point. And there was actually 4 children in the vehicle. And of course, they've been taken into custody by the County Department of Children and Family Services. I mean, why not? You know, the mother's been injured under these circumstances. You've got a child endangerment issue that the mother actually might be confronted with. Nobody has said anything about that yet, but that's a real possibility. You've got a loaded shotgun in the back of the car with 4 children. Child endangerment, it's got it written all over it. I mean, I hope they don't charge it under the circumstances, but there are some aggressive prosecutors out there that may turn around and do it, not to mention the Department of Children's Services, because the realities are is that if these kids are exposed to that kind of behavior, there's people out there that are going to be clamoring. Just that simple. But I just wanted to say, look, people, you know, you've heard me talk enough time about safety, about guns and everything, and this is just a pure example of why you need to be extremely careful with weapons, and your weapons always have to be secured. Okay? Hopefully the mom is going to be okay, but I'm just thinking about the psychological impact of these children as well under those circumstances to see something like that. Let's secure our weapons properly from our children. This issue comes up when we start talking about child shootings at schools. How do they get the weapons? Once again, parents not securing these. Now, it's not in every single case, but in some cases, it's all about the fact that the weapons were not secured, and we have to think that way now. All right? Okay. Let's move on. All right. You know, I always like reading emails. So here's my first email. Jim, I really enjoyed listening to your show each week. It is very informative, but I would like to make a comment. You talk about police officers getting killed, but what about firefighters? They are also at risk. And they have been, and there have been situations where fires have actually been started to draw the firemen there, and then they've been shot intentionally by an active shooter. I thought it was important to mention. Thanks, Mike, Bronx, New York. Well, look, first of all, Mike, thanks for that. And I do agree with you. I don't mean to undermine or forget the firefighters. You know, the people in uniform always seem to be the target of something at some point. I'm originally from New York. I get it. The New York City Fire Department does an excellent job. And is what I did. I turned around and I did do a little research. Let me just tell you, those situations, as Mike said, definitely has taken place. Some of you might remember in Long Beach, California, June of last year, there was a call in that there was an explosive device at a retirement home of all places, and the fire department responded to that. And when they responded to the retirement home, a 77-year-old resident, who's the one that was responsible for calling in, making that phone call, he killed a fire captain and wounded a second fireman that came to respond to it. 77-year-old active shooter killed a fire captain along and wounded a second fireman. So yes, these things happen. I mean, you could go back further than that. Webster, New York, they've had situations, Mike, and maybe that's why you're mentioning this, because in New York, they've had these same scenarios where they look at these individuals who in fact have, well, wounded and killed firefighters responding to these fires. One individual, William Spangler, he did some ambushing in New York. Firefighters responded to a pre-dawn house fire, and he killed himself after gunning down four firefighters. And again, this was in New York. They had another one that I'll just mention very quickly. I'm not sure if anybody remembers the other ones, but there was a situation that took place. It was in Oregon, actually. And in Oregon, this individual was an arsonist, and he sets his own home on fire just to ambush firefighters. And that was, you might remember, this was on the news. This was in October of 2018. And he torched his own house, and then he used a rifle at the first responders. He was 60 years old and eventually turned the gun on himself and ended a brief standoff with the police. So yes, Mike, I do understand that firefighters are also subject to these shootings and dying in office. And I will look into getting some more statistical information. I was looking it up. I didn't see as many stats out there as you can imagine with police officers, but certainly that's not to forget that we also appreciate the firemen. For those who might remember it, you know, at the Twin Towers, I mean, a lot of firemen lost their lives as well. One of my high school buddies was a fireman, in upstate New York. And these guys put their lives at risk all the time for people. So I didn't mean to at least not discuss, you know, them and the risk that they face. So shout out to all those firefighters that are out there as well. And that's just not the ones that are in the city. Let's not forget the firefighters who try to put out these forest fires and these, some of these, especially in California, have been horrific, and firemen have died there as well. So all firemen, no matter whether they're working in the cities or working out there in the forest areas. Okay, next email. Jim, the recent active shooter at the bank in Florida is scary stuff. You've said it before. Don't think it can't happen to you. These people had no idea when they went to work that day that they would not walk out. By the way, Florida seems to have a lot of shootings. And this is from Lucinda from San Diego. Well, Lucinda, let me just tell you, that's true. It appears to me, I will say, I'm not going to say Florida is leading the charge on this because I don't necessarily think that. I believe Florida is one of the states that has, you know, about the open carry or being able to carry, you know, concealed weapons. But this particular gunman, he had issues because even his girlfriend said that he had problems and he had talked about killing people and apparently got thrown out of school or something because he had threatened that he was going to do something with the, you know, at school. Now, in this particular case, he actually called the police department. So he called the authorities and said that he had opened up fire inside the bank. And, you know, he said, I've shot five people. Now, SWAT actually had to come out, of course, and they stormed the bank. And he surrendered and was taken into custody. So at least he surrendered. You know, I'm not sure what his motivations were. And, you know, they identified him. He's a 21-year-old. He lives in that particular area. And apparently three of the people worked at the bank itself. So now you're talking once again about violence in the workplace. Two of them were customers. And another one had escaped out the back. And I believe that's who it was to call 911. But apparently this suspect's ex-girlfriend, and again, I call him a suspect because even though he was caught and the rest of it, he hasn't been convicted, that she said that he wanted everybody to die. Now, she said that he's had issues like this before, and he was a prison guard trainee. So he was actually in training for a law enforcement position. Now, sadly, one of the workers killed was a mother of two and had only been hired at the bank within the last couple of months. And the other victims, like I said, some of them were other employees, and also there was a customer in the bank that got killed also. So these situations are definitely sad. There's no doubt about it, Lucinda, but I'm not going to label Florida in terms of what they have. Some of the issues do stand out because of the Pulse nightclub that was in Florida. And the situation at the in Parkland, Florida, at the school. And there's been a few other places that have in Florida that have had issues at the airport outside of Fort Lauderdale had an active shooter. You might remember that in the baggage claim area. So they do have a tendency to make the news, but I'm not going to say it's any worse in Florida than other places. I'm not willing to go that far yet. Although I will be looking at the statistics, so that does have me a little bit curious from that standpoint. So we'll see. Okay, we have a third one here. Jim, I knew you basically just talk about domestic terrorism, but can you mention about missing children? This is a serious problem in our country, but it really doesn't get the national attention it deserves. Thank you, Irene, Baltimore, Maryland. Well, you know what, Irene? I did look that up because I was kind of curious about that. And believe it or not, so this is more of a public service announcement with this, and that's why I decided to go ahead and read that email on the air. Because unfortunately, the real situation, many children are missing apparently, and it's never reported. And there's no reliable way to determine the total number of children who are actually missing in the United States. I mean, this is horrific. I mean, these are our children. And when a child is reported missing to law enforcement, the federal law requires that the child be entered into the FBI's National Crime Information Center, also known as the NCIC. So look, for those of you out there that have children that leave, run away, whatever the case may be, get on the FBI website, get their names and their pictures out there. Because I got to tell you, according to the FBI, the recent statistics, there were 424,066 entries for missing children in 2018 alone. In 2017, the total number of missing children entries with the FBI into the NCIC was 464,324. That's a lot of kids on a national basis. That's a lot. And it's what the FBI is saying is that these children or the parents or relatives are not necessarily always giving them all the names. So this is only the ones that are reported. Now, the missing children statistics, case type, 92% are endangered runaways, 4% are family abductions, 3% critically missing young children ages 18 to 20. Now, the young adults, I should say, ages 18 to 20. And then less than 1% are non-family abductions. But you look at 1% times the number that are missing and not even reported. I think probably when somebody's abducted, that's probably being reported. 1% lost, injured, or otherwise missing children as well. So that's another 1%. Now, apparently, of the nearly 23,500 runaways reported in 2018, 1 in 7 were likely victims of child sex trafficking. So these numbers, when you really think about it, are astounding. And again, I had no idea. We really don't hear that much about it. The only time that we really hear anything about children missing and abductions is when they do the Amber Alerts. Then we see something, but that's not all the time. So there's not really, and I know our Mr. Walsh, because of his own child, I think there's been some things on TV, there's been some programs regarding missing children, et cetera. But other than that, there really isn't any national attention to that. So maybe the politicians need to get on the, you know, get on the stick with that and see what we can do and put something out there that's a little bit more for the general public to see and understand. Now, I want to give you another one. They also have some statistics on this with children because they have what they call the cyber tip line, And that's a national mechanism for the public and electronic service providers to report instances of suspected child sexual exploitation. In 2017, the cyber tip line received more than 10 million reports, most of which related to child sexual abuse images, online enticement, including sextortion, child sex trafficking, and child sexual molestation. Think about this. These are our children, and these kind of things are out there. Again, these statistics are absolutely horrible. So I do appreciate you asking me to mention that on the air, and I consider that like a public service message at this point. I don't know if you want to classify it as domestic terrorism, but certainly this is not something that we want to be thinking about. And Irene, I want to thank you for bringing that to my attention. And please, people out there, let's pay attention to our young people and watching out to make sure some of these things that I just label off to you are not taking place. Okay? All right. Again, the number is 818-602-4929 if anybody wants to make a comment about any of that. Okay. Let's turn our attention real quick. You know, you've heard me say a number of things about schools over the last, year or so, whatever it's been now that I've been on the air. And I do believe in this because I think our children do need to be protected. And I do a lot of public speaking. And I also speak at businesses, et cetera, and we do the active shooter training. And a lot of times some of the attendees are asking or concerned about children, the children in the schools. And there's a lot out there on it. And, you know, there are some good safety tips. So I'm going to go through 9 of the more effective school lockdown tips. Now, one of the things that they talk about is keeping the doors locked and avoiding codes and having reverse evacuation protocols they feel will help to ensure that the lockdowns are implemented quickly. So that's something to think about. But I have to tell you, honestly, they'll think there's a 100% solution to all of this because there's no one-size-fits-all lockdown protocol that will work properly in every school because procedures must reflect differences in school design and local law enforcement response capabilities. Lockdown protocols that look great on paper or during basic drills initiated by administrators can have a significant gap when tested by actual events versus the practices that people may have and that the school administrators we have. Now, there have been instances out there where the implementation of school lockdowns range from a minute to several minutes in actual incidents and have often seen fail rates of 60% to 81% during simulations that require individual staff members to make and communicate the lockdown decision. Think about that. Now, it is important to provide staff the tools they need to keep the building secure throughout the school day. There's no doubt about that. You got to have keys. There's other things that you can do. You've got the locks. You got the procedures in place. Now, I'm going to tell you, there are some lessons out there that I've learned even when doing some of the assessments that my team and I get out there and do. Because, as I've told you before, we get out and do site assessments. We've done schools, all types of different businesses from wildlife conservancies to the automobile dealerships, real estate companies, law firms, regular business environments, office environments, I should say, schools. I mean, we've done so many different industries at this point, manufacturers, distributors, hotels. So look, let me tell you, there's some lessons out there. And, don't always focus all of your efforts on active shooter situations. But the schools, they only have one type of lockdown procedures, which are more likely to have planned failure during a crisis. Codes can kill. Sometimes people have these codes, but then they have so many different codes that when a code happens, everybody's trying to figure out which code. So be careful about how many codes you really have. And all staff should be issued keys and participate in staff development and some form of lockdown drill. All staff, not just key staff. And when I say key, I mean, the main staff, principal staff. And I'm going to tell you, doors should be locked during instructional times and when the door is not actively in use. That's what they say. Now, the only thing my objection to that is, and that's one of the factors that they put out there about doors being locked during instructional times. I don't know. You got to be very careful with that. To me, because of a fire and something happens and people can't get out, students can't get out. So that's the only little caveat that I see with that scenario. Now, if they're not trained with staff-initiated drills, individual staff members and teachers are less likely to respond effectively during a crisis. That's why all teachers, all staff have got to go through the drills. And if somebody misses work that day due to an illness or they're on vacation, whatever the case may be, make sure that they're brought up to speed. Because I'm going to tell you, basing the lockdown decision on the location of the threat instead of the nature of the threat can be dangerous. And people do that. They base the lockdown decision on the location of the threat instead of the nature of the threat. Don't do it that way. That can be very dangerous. You got to be more open than that. And keep in mind that reverse evacuation protocols and drills are critical. Critical. Now, room clear protocols can also be important. Clearing out the room, the protocols. Do you have the protocols in place? Or have you just had a meeting telling everybody what you're going to do? Now, I will tell you, I'm not giving you a list of everything. This is not a complete list of considerations. I'm just saying that some of these things that we found is the most common, and there are opportunities for improvement in school lockdowns. So let me keep going and let me get into the 9 pitfalls themselves. But I wanted to give you that little measure first, all right, before we move on. So the first thing I want you to keep in mind is don't focus all your efforts on an active shooter situation. If lockdown training and drills are forced on an active shooter situation, a higher fail rate occurs when other types of incidents occur or are simulated. So in other words, if you're doing like an earthquake drill or a fire drill, all right? So don't just focus all your efforts on active shooter situations. You want to make sure you still do all the other drills also. I remember when I was in school coming along so many years ago, what did we do? We did fire drills. I wasn't in California, so we never had to worry about doing earthquake drills in upstate New York, but we did fire drills. So just remember, don't focus all of your efforts on active shooter situations. You want to do the other drills as well. Second one, schools that only have one type of lockdown procedure are more likely to have planned failure during a crisis. Now, look, I know it's normally good to keep things simple in school crisis planning, but it's been found that schools that have only one protocol based on an active shooter situation and other crisis events have a high fail rate because school administrators are adverse to overreaching in a situation they feel is too minor to warrant a school lockdown. This can allow a situation to escalate into a deadly event because an early opportunity to lock down the building is missed. Be careful. Having a lower level preventative or soft lockdown option is important because most situations where lockdowns are needed do not involve weapons. Okay, those threats that come in, people are saying things, the school goes into an immediate lockdown, somebody made a threat. But I'm telling you, have a lower level preventative or soft lockdown option as well. All right, because every situation does not apply to a necessarily to an active shooter. So have those backups as well. Okay. I mentioned to you about codes. Codes can kill. Look, planned failure has occurred in actual events and evaluations because the school staff members often confuse different codes when they are used in a crisis. Be careful about codes and how many different codes you have. Keep it simple and easy to remember. Failure to do so could easily result in mass loss of life. You want to make sure your codes are simple. Keep it down to three codes or so is my suggestion, and go with that. You turn around and have 15 different codes. Somebody's got to run through some list in their head, and under the circumstances, they're going to be nervous. And here they are trying to figure out which code is going to apply in this. Number four, all staff should be issued keys and participate in staff development in some form of lockdown drill. Now, look, I will tell you, when we do site assessments, we go out and we talk to these clients. And sometimes they tell us, well, only this person has a key, only this person has a key, and only this person has a key. Well, you better hope something doesn't happen to that person, because those important keys, in order to be able to do the lockdown properly, you're not going to have access to that. So, and I know some businesses are really skeptical about giving everybody keys, keys, keys. Well, that's true. And what happens when somebody leaves the company? That's the most often question that we get, or the question we get most often. Well, if they leave, what do we do? Well, unfortunately, you got to change the locks. Now, some people don't want to do that, but if they have the key and the locks haven't been changed, again, some of that could really apply to what your turnover rate is. You got a high turnover. Okay. That could be cumbersome. But look, if you're going to keep the keys with strategic individuals, okay, increase the number of strategic individuals if you don't want to give the keys to everybody. All right. But just remember, if one door is not locked soon enough because a single employee is unable to do the lockdown, it can happen. Mass casualties can happen. So it's important to allow staff the tools they need to keep the building secure throughout the day. And I'll tell you something else I think people fail to do. Your staff should be given ample practice in physically performing lockdown procedures before a crisis. And I don't care whether that's a school or whether or not that's a business. Practice it. Otherwise, when they get in the situation, they're not going to perform correctly. They're going to be nervous. I talk about that in the active shooter trainings that we do. Panic reaction versus reflex reaction. Anybody wanting to call 818-602-4929. At any rate, businesses or schools should practice. Something happens, you'll have a reflex reaction versus a panic reaction. Okay, now, doors should be locked during instructional times, they say. and when the door is not actively in use. Okay, not actively in use, I get it. I'm going to tell you, some schools require teachers to teach with their doors locked as a preventative measure. The way the school operates can impact the practicality of this approach, but in general, you got to keep in mind it's only a small adjustment to making the school culture. Some educators feel that keeping doors open creates a positive and inviting environment. But the experiences out there say a locked door does not have to have a negative effect on the class environment. Look, when we go out and we talk to the different schools and the different school administrators, they do talk about how they want their children to always feel like they're in a positive environment. So they're very, very cautious. Like when we do our site assessments at schools, we do it when the children are not there. So we do it like on vacations, things of that nature. We do the active shooter training. We kind of do it the same way. Again, some of this is not to impact or upset the children. And we do get that. We understand that. But look, there's another piece to this. Sometimes these children have to understand what to do as well. This is not something that's not new. I mean, these kids, they're at home. They're watching TV when these incidents happen. Their parents are at home watching these things happen on TV. So therefore, you know, when the children are out there, you have to at least give that some consideration as well. Or at least practice it enough times that when something happens, the children automatically know what to do also. We can't shield these children from all of this. And I understand the mindset of the administration about the children not being, you know, impact, you know, from a negative standpoint. They don't want to feel that they're in a lockdown situation when they're sitting in a classroom, you know, learning things. But think about the parents who probably in some respects feel more secure if something like that was going on in terms of locking the doors. Now, look, as I said, the caveat, in my opinion, is that you got to be careful about locking doors during the day. The fire departments have a big issue, I know, even with businesses, with locking the doors. Because of the fact that if something happens, there's a fire, and now people can't get out. I mean, those situations have happened also. So we got to move cautiously with locking these doors, in my opinion. But again, what's out there, they say, you know, that you can lock the doors. So I don't know. Or that some schools do lock the doors during instructional times. Now, some of these active shooters, of course, aren't necessarily just doing it when the kids are in the classroom. I mean, some of these kids that are doing the active shooting are doing it when the kids are in recess. So the kids are all in the halls, you know, things of that nature. And as you know, and as I emphasized before, look, there's no 100% foolproof to this. All right. Six, if they're not trained with staff initiated drills, individual staff members and teachers are less likely to respond effectively during a crisis. Think about that. What have I said? Reflex reaction versus a panic reaction. If you go over some of these tips that we talk about on the air over and over and over again in your mind, if in fact something happens, you're not going to have a panic reaction. You're going to have a reflex reaction. Panic gets people killed or hurt. Now, the threat itself that indicates the need for a lockdown often takes place in parts of the school away from the main office. They don't do it by the main office. That's why you have to train these other individuals too. This means that it's important to hold drills where different staff members are required to make the decision to initiate a school lockdown without consulting anyone. They've got to be given the power to do that as opposed to calling the office and say, should we do a lockdown? I just saw something. They've got to be given the power to make these individual calls themselves, you know, decisions. I mean, call mean a decision. All right. So therefore, they have to be trained in order to be able to do that. I mean, some of this stuff, when you really think about it, it's really common sense, but it's not always applied. It's not always applied. Okay. Now, look. Seven, you're basing the lockdown decision on the location of the threat instead of the nature of the threat, and that, people, can be dangerous. All right? Basing the lockdown decision on the location of the threat instead of the nature of the threat can be dangerous. Now, I will say, it's often referred to as a lockdown, lockout protocol. Now, if you take that approach, it has a very high fail rate. 81% has been a number that's been thrown out there, because it's very difficult for employees to quickly decide which approach is best when they're presented with these different scenarios. So do we have a lockout or a lockdown? Lockout protocols, you know what that means. That means, you know, locking all the doors, et cetera. Or do we do a lockdown with everything, you know, with the entire school, you know, where nobody can get in or out, basically. That's what they're talking about out there. Now, number eight, reverse evacuation protocols and drills are critical. Lockdowns, sheltering procedures for severe weather and other critical life-saving protocols cannot be implemented as rapidly if there's no mechanism to promptly return students who are outside of the building in an organized fashion. Now, think about that for a second. What are we talking about? Reverse evacuation. There's an active shooter. It's recess. People are outside. Do you do your drills to get people back inside? Most people don't think about it that way. Most people think about it from the inside heading out as opposed to on the outside heading in. So what you need to do and understand is that you need to do it ways, because some of these active shooters, and I've talked about them in some of the past shows, some of these kids have actually posted up outside. When kids were outside, they started shooting the kids. Well, you have to think about the reverse evacuation plans too. What do we do if the kids are out on the schoolyard playing and now there's an active shooter? Now you want to get them back inside. What's the plan? Where do they go? How do they get back inside? Are they all going to be trying to get through one door? That's not going to work. So think about that. Now, I'm going to tell you, most school staff are already familiar with the basic concept of what I'm talking about, but very few understand that it's a formal procedure and it can delay action while considering what to do when they need to return to the building quickly. Most people don't practice that. Businesses, not too much of a problem, because most of them, it's everything is going on the inside and not the outside. There's one business that we went to one time and did a site assessment, and they had the evacuation area, which was in their parking lot, all marked off. So basically, depending on your last name, they had a section for the people from A to C. They had a section, we'll say, from D, E, and F, et cetera. Well, the problem with that is that's all fine and good, but suppose you have a domestic violence situation. The person knows that the company has some security, so it's a secure facility. And now what they do is call in a bomb threat. And now if the person's last name is Apple, they're going to know exactly where Apple's going to go. They're going to be standing there under the sign A, B, and C. Don't do it that way. You can do sections, but don't label those sections, in my opinion. I think that could be potentially an issue. Or a disgruntled former employee that's trying to get to a supervisor or somebody who they were unhappy with. They're going to know the procedure because they work for the company. So what are they going to do? Call in a bomb threat. What are they going to do? Wait outside. And now here this person is going to go right under the sign that says A, B, or C, and now they know exactly where they are. So be careful with those kind of things also. Now, they probably figured that made sense. They can do a little head count and checklist for everybody. But look, that's not a safety measure. So it shouldn't be done that way. Okay, room clear protocols, which is number nine. Room clear protocols are very important out there, okay? Schools have to have a mechanism to quickly clear students from a room when there is a threat. Now, there's some schools out there that use the room clear procedure to send students to another part of the school quickly during a small crisis that does not require a school-wide evacuation, but does not necessitate crowbar moving students away from a dangerous situation. Crowbar meaning, you know, forcing them out. So you also have to do it from an individual classroom standpoint. This is where we would go in the event that we have to evacuate the classroom. All right. Look, here's what I want you to understand. School shootings and other forms of school violence are not just a school's problem or a law enforcement problem. They involve schools, families, and the community. An adolescent comes to school with a collective life experience, both positive and negative, shaped by the environments of family, school, peers, community, and culture. Out of that collective experience come values, prejudices, bias, emotions, and a student's responses to training, stress, and authority. His or her behavior at school is affected by the entire range of experiences and influence. Keep that in mind. No one factor is decisive. By the same token, I want you to also keep in mind that no one factor is completely without effect. which means that when a student has shown signs of potential violent behavior, schools and other community institutions do have the capacity and, by the way, the responsibility to keep that potential from turning real. And I think I've told you on a couple other shows where, in fact, some of these kids have been caught because now people are starting to speak up. And, you know, this business about schools not doing what they're supposed to do, schools not training or paying attention to what these students are saying, a lot of that's turning around right now. And we need that. We need administrators paying attention, teachers paying attention, peers, which means students as well, paying attention, and parents paying attention. Now, the next piece along these same lines is, when you think about it, why is it that the inner city schools don't have the same issues? Why is it that the inner city schools do not have the same issues as these the schools that we're talking about right now? You know, the suburban schools. Well, look, they say that, here's the deal. Inner city schools already have a lot of procedures in place, unfortunately, because of the gang violence and things of that nature. Some of them have metal detectors. You can't even get into the school unless you pass through a metal detector. Now, I will say that is very sad. But the inner city schools have had issues. And maybe that's not all inner city schools, so don't be writing to me with any hate mail. I'm just saying, just in general, okay, that's what they say, that the inner city schools already have metal detectors because they've had problems that go back a long time with gang affiliations, things of that nature. So they have to make sure nobody's bringing a weapon on. And they also make sure that the doors are locked from outside, and that some of the doors are even equipped with sensors to make sure that any door that's open, that there's a signal that goes off in the administration's office and lets them know. And even have alarms that go off in hallways when any of these doors are breached. They also lock every side door, and security guards constantly patrol. Any would-be mass shooter would have an extremely difficult time to be on some kind of rampage, only because of the fact that these schools have people patrolling already. They've got the alarms in place. They've got metal detectors, and they have also the personnel and the training at this point. And, you know, again, it's sad but true that these schools have to have resorted to that, but lessons learned, basically. And now the suburban schools are now learning that they have to do something. So, you know, just be mindful at that point. Okay. Let's move on. You know, I always like doing an historical piece. Now, right now, we're having a lot of issues in Washington, D.C. I don't have to tell you that. And no, I'm not getting into any of the politics or anything. You know, I'm not getting into any of the politics or anything. But when we start talking about shootings, now, we know there was a shooting a year or so ago at a baseball game for the politicians. There was an active shooter. And different people got shot. Now, you look at that, and everybody was completely dumbfounded by how something like that could happen. One of the things that I always talk about in my speeches, I talk about it on the radio. These situations are not new. So let's go back in time. 1954. Yes, 1954. There was a shooting inside the United States Capitol, inside the Capitol. Now, the facts are simple enough, and I'll get into the detail in a minute, but let me give you an overview. There was an attack on March 1st, 1954 by four Puerto Rican nationalists. They shot 30 rounds from semi-automatic pistols. From the ladies' gallery. Now, back in those days, they had a ladies' gallery. I doubt if they still have a ladies' gallery. Okay, so ladies, you know, don't be writing to me. They had a ladies' gallery back then. I'm sure they don't have that. But they called it a balcony for visitors of the House of Representatives. All right? So it was in the House of Representatives chamber and United States Capitol. The reason why they did the shooting was because they wanted to highlight their desire for Puerto Rican independence from the United States rule. And these nationalists, there were three guys and one woman. Yep, there was a woman involved, and she was the gang leader, quite frankly. And when they started shooting, they unfurled a Puerto Rican flag. They began shooting at the representatives. It was the 83rd Congress. And guess what they were debating on? And that's why I picked this one. I have to tell you the honest to goodness truth. This is 1954, as a reminder. They were debating on an immigration bill. Now, you know I don't get political, but here we go again. And I guess what this is saying is that obviously this is not new. Now, I told you 30 rounds were fired. Well, five representatives were wounded, one more seriously than the other ones. And they all recovered, and the assailants were arrested, and they were tried and convicted in federal court. And now they were given long sentences, all right? But basically is what it ended up being because of their ages. They were given like 75 years in prison. Now, what I don't understand when I did this research was that in 1978, 1979, they were all pardoned by President Jimmy Carter, and all four of them were released, and they all returned to Puerto Rico for a hero's welcome. Now, you think about this, pistols, semi-automatic pistols. They used the Walther P-38, which, if I'm not mistaken, was the same one that James Bond used. They also had a Luger, a 9mm, and they also had an artillery Luger, a 9mm. They were all 9mm, basically. So here we go again. What did gun control do about those? Absolutely nothing. Not a gun control issue. These guys probably brought their weapons with them somehow or another, because back in those days, they weren't checking all this on the planes like they do now. Now, on the attack itself, they basically started off at Grand Central Station in Manhattan. So you see what they do. They come from a distance. Now they're taking the train down into the Washington, D.C. area. Again, they were on a train. It's not a plane. So they took the train to Washington, D.C., and then went the short distance from Union Station to the Capitol. Now, at first, they were going to postpone it because some of them had gotten there a little bit later than expected. But when the woman spoke up, and she said, no, we're not going to wait. And she's the one that forced it, where the other guy said, okay, you know what? So just those three with her went along. Now, it could have been more. Now, when they reached the visitors gallery above the House of Chamber, they sat while the representative discussed the Mexican economy, here we go, and issues of immigration. So you look at these things and say, okay, and this is consistent with what I've said in the past, and that is history repeats itself. None of this is new. We think that it is, but it's not. We're just young enough, you know, we're just too young at the time to know about it. And a lot of people now are too young to know about the history, and nobody goes back and looks at this. Now, I'm going to tell you, the wounded lawmakers, because I thought this was interesting, because if they're just shooting at random at people, because some people say, okay, who was shot? Were they all Republicans or all Democrats? Like the shooter we had last year was an active shooter. Well, there were five representatives, I think I told you, that were shot in the attack. The wounded lawmakers were Alvin Bentley. He was a Republican from Michigan. He took a bullet to the chest. Clifford Davis, Democrat from Tennessee, he was shot in the leg. Ben Jensen was a Republican from Iowa. He was also shot, and he was shot in the back, as well as George Fallon. He was a Democrat out of Maryland. And then Kenneth Roberts, he was a Democrat out of Alabama. And, you know, this lady who was the ringleader, she claimed that she fired all of her shots into the ceiling. One of the individuals, their pistol jammed. So they say that all 30 shots were fired by one of them, only one of them. And he was the one responsible for wounding the five lawmakers. Now, the woman, upon being arrested, claimed, I did not come to kill anyone. I came to die for Puerto Rico. So she expected that when they all started opening fire, that security, you know, would have shot them, and she ended up, basically, she would have been a martyr. Now, when they got convicted, they all went to different prisons. One went to, I think it was in New York. One went to Atlanta. One even went to Alcatraz. So when Carter released all of them, he released them from four different of these penitentiaries. Now, I'm not sure that I understand what the logic was in terms of why he released released these people. I mean, you're talking, they had 75-year sentences. He releases them in 1978. That was basically only 20 years. So they only did 20 years in jail for this. Now, there are people out there that are committing crimes, you know, a lesser degree than this, getting more time than this. And that's why you look at some of this and say, okay, we got to make sure we're fair with the way that we, in fact, do the sentencing. I think that they're taking a look at that, and I think that they need to, make a long story short. All right. You've been listening to Jim Potts on LA Talk Radio. It's time to close out the show. But let me remind you that you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/JimPottsAuthor. Be sure to join me next week. And if you like what you heard, spread the word. Until then, be aware, be vigilant, and be safe. But most importantly, be a reluctant victim. See you next time. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Listen Up with Jim Potts, only on LA Talk Radio.